Good afternoon. Welcome once again to Line One, your health connection from Alaska Public Media here in Anchorage, Alaska. I'm your co-host, Dr. Thad Woodard. You know, there's abundant evidence that we humans are not the most rational decision makers. Daniel Kahneman won the Nobel Prize in Economics by demonstrating that we commonly make irrational decisions, basically because we have a very poor understanding and appreciation of probability, and that we depend on how our choices are framed, not on much evidence sometimes. And then there's Duke Professor of Psychology and Behavioral Economics, Dan Ehrle. He reveals some very subtle tricks our minds will play on us in his book entitled Predictably Irrational, The Hidden Forces That Shape Our Decisions. It gets more important than just making bad decisions when it comes to health, because poor decisions can have some grave consequences. And our guest today is Dr. Sarah Gorman. She is co-author of Denying to the Grave, Why We Ignore the Facts That Will Save Us. This is a book that examines the psychology of healthcare decision-making and theorizes about public perception of risk. It includes some tips for the general public about how to discriminate between valid and invalid science. And when I think about science, I think about evidence as another word that may fit there, and pointers for public health professionals and doctors as myself on how we can communicate better with people who don't really believe what science has taught us about health. In addition, and I think importantly, Sarah is co-founder of Critica, which is a community committed to making rational decisions about health and security, and that link to that is on our website at alaskamedia.org. Sarah earned an MPH in health policy and management from Columbia University and a PhD in English literature from Harvard University. Sarah, welcome to Line One.
Thank you for having me.
It's a pleasure to have you, and I can't help but ask about how you got to public health from English literature.
Sure. So I was doing my PhD in English literature up at Harvard, and I got to a point where I was teaching and writing my dissertation, and I just, something was missing from my life and my career, and I wanted to do something more dynamic, more fast-paced, and my parents, one of whom obviously wrote the book with me as my co-author on the book, are both physicians, and I had always been interested in healthcare. And I discovered public health as I went back to think about what I wanted to do as a career, and got some great mentoring and experience at the Harvard School of Public Health while I was finishing my PhD, and started writing a lot about public health issues, which was how I ultimately came to write my book.
Right. And one more thing I can't help but mention, there's a lot of similarities between your background and Eula Biss, who I've interviewed a couple years ago on her book on immunity and inoculation. She's a essayist at Northwestern who got a Master's of Fine Arts nonfiction writing, I think it was, at Iowa. But interestingly, one of her parents was a physician as well, and it was one of the more enjoyable readings by somebody who is a mother and really explored the whole issue of vaccinations, because so many of her friends were questioning the safety of those. And it was a great read. And so it's interesting that both you and her both have come from a medical and a humanities background. So I thought I'd mention that.
Certainly. And I also read that book and admired the openness and the honesty, and I think with which she talks about some of the struggles she had with deciding on vaccination. And so I think it's a great read as well.
I thought she did a very good job of just talking about risk, and she did it in a very literary way, which was enjoyable and quite different for me. Let me remind our listeners real quickly before we get into the program any deeper. If you've got questions about the program today, you'd like to ask Sarah Gorman any questions, there are a couple of ways to get a hold of us. Our local number is 550-8433. You can email us during this next hour at line1@alaskapublic.org. And we do have a toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. So I'm a clinician, and every day I deal with trying to provide the best, most evidence-based information to patients. And I know your father, who was the co-author, Dr. Jack Gorman, was a clinician, a psychiatrist in practice. So I'm sure he face these issues every day. And I can somewhat see how you might have got interested in this topic from the whole issue of public health, where there's a huge need to try to get across to the public what we can do to help them really make better healthcare decisions. But how did you see that need for the book, Denying to the Grave? Is that something your father brought to you, or something that you took to him, or just kind of happened at the same time?
So interestingly, it did sort of happen at the same time, actually. We were thinking along the same wavelength without even knowing it. I was becoming much more interested in the anti-vaccine sentiment. As I was getting more and more involved in writing about public health, I kept coming across this issue of why are people not refusing to have their children have their vaccines and insisting that they cause autism despite the evidence. And I had written a couple of things about risk perception and the anti-vaccine sentiment and movement, and that were very well received, that people felt that this was a perspective that was very important on the issue. And then at the same time, my father was actually getting more interested in this question about why do people own guns? Why do people keep guns in their homes for safety when really the evidence shows that having a gun in the home actually makes people less safe. And so when I talked to him about the anti-vaccine movement and my interest in writing more about that and possibly a book, because I thought there were many applications of some of the issues there, he actually said, you know, I've been thinking about it as well with the gun issue, and maybe we should write this book together. So that's how it all started.
Yeah. So if we're going to explore this idea of how do we make good decisions, it's logical to me to say, all right, somehow we've got to root our decisions in some kind of evidence or fact. And so how do we know what is good evidence, I guess, is the question, isn't it? If we're going to make good decisions, then we have to base it on some kind of rooted information or way to make a decision. So how would you answer that?
Yeah, so I think putting aside doctors and scientists and all the technicalities of how you read the method section of a scientific paper, I think if you're just consuming media and trying to make your way through different sources of information, we do talk in the book a little bit about how you can spot some things that might tip you off that something is not necessarily legitimate. And I think, you know, one thing to be very wary of for everyone, including doctors and scientists, need to do this as well, is to really look out for some really dramatic language when you read news articles about studies, things that insist that something is a breakthrough. It doesn't mean that it's necessarily not a breakthrough, but it's something that you want to investigate more when there's a lot of dramatic language. And you also always want to look at a couple of different sources at once. You want to see a couple of different coverages of that same story and see if there are consistencies or inconsistencies. You might want to really, the best thing is to try to look at the study itself if you have access to that and not just read press releases or journalistic coverage. And, you know, also pay attention to who's funding the study and what the affiliation of the writer, the lead author is, and try to educate yourself a bit about the different journals and which journal. You can just look on Wikipedia about the influence of a particular journal. That can also give you some clues. So no one of those things by itself, I think, will tell you whether something is legitimate or not, but looking at them together, you can often piece together whether something looks like solid evidence and a good study or not.
Mm-hmm. You know, I think the generic thing you're saying is it takes a little work, and you know, you have to kind of go out there, and you kind of have to approach information with an open mind that perhaps it isn't right, and then see if you can find information that is independent, that corroborates that, or maybe shows that it's not true. I remember doing a program, and somebody commented that we were very biased in our information about somebody we were talking about, and they said that person had, she sent me an email after the program saying, well, this person has even lost his license in the state of Pennsylvania because of things. And it took me no time to look up his license in Pennsylvania, which was still in effect. And then putting his name in and lost a license, there was a huge number of websites that came up stating that. So it was clear that somebody was just promoting this information, which was not true, and people were just reading it on a website or multiple websites. So it, right. It does take a little bit of effort to do this, I guess. And I think that seems to me maybe one reason people don't get to the right information or valuable information, reliable information maybe is a better way to put it.
Yeah, it certainly takes some effort, and it also takes some practice and getting used to what kinds of things can go wrong with some of the information that's out there. And there's a great website called healthnewsreview.org that I really recommend to people, because what it does is it kind of goes through some of the most popular coverage in the past week and will often show that there are problems with the way something was covered. And it's not always a big scandal. It usually isn't. Usually it's just that something is misleading. And that happens, unfortunately, frequently with coverage of health news. And what it does, what happens is if you really read that every day and understand how the people who are writing those articles think about how health news is covered, you can also start to hone your own skills about what you should be looking for, what are the mm-hmm. things that could be misleading or go wrong, and what are some of the red flags. So it takes some time and some practice, but it really is within everyone's grasp, yeah, I think.
That's a good point. And I would also mention, I would agree that the Health News Review is a good site for that, and we have a link to that on our kind of our I have a list of websites on our website that we commonly refer people to or make recommendations for. What about science? And there seems to be an undercurrent of what's not real facts. And I think there's generally a misunderstanding of science and what science is. And I was trying to get at that with my previous question. Is that seems to be the best way, I would say, that we can get at what is most likely the truth, what's real. You want to comment on that? Because you do talk about it in your book.
Sure. Obviously, I believe, and like any other public health professional and scientist, that as you say, science, the scientific process is a great process that really does get us toward knowing the truth about these issues. But I think what happens is that we're not always educated about science in the right way. So we sort of get a picture of science that makes it seem a lot neater than it actually is. Whereas science is quite a messy process, and there's a lot of it takes a lot of time to actually establish something, especially in health, when you're dealing with very complex questions like causes of cancer and things that chronic diseases that take a long time to develop. It's very complex how you actually go about determining those things, and it takes a long time and many studies to really establish something like that. So I think what happens is that we get a little bit of a inaccurate picture of science when we are first taught about it growing up, and then it's hard to adjust our sort of vision of it to really match what goes on, and we expect it to give us more absolute answers than it can sometimes. So I think it's important to understand how science really unfolds in a realistic manner.
Yeah, it's really, it's kind of, I've heard it said, it gets closer and closer and closer and closer approximations to what is probably real. It's never going to be the truth. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think one of the things we talk about in the book is how scientists are trained to also communicate with us is very, they err on the side of caution. They kind of use the language of the lab, which is to say that everything is always 95% true and nothing is ever 100%. That's just mm-hmm. sort of the way we set up our statistics and how we conduct these studies. And the problem with that, as we talk about in the book, is that people really look for 100% certainty in their life. We psychologically, we don't like to feel that something is uncertain. The more important it is, the less tolerant we are of any kind of uncertainty, even if it's at 5%. So there's a little bit of a disjunct between the way that scientists think about things and the way that they're trained to speak about their findings and the way that the human brain actually interprets that. The 5% suddenly becomes very large.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that gets into another issue that you talk about, and that's that emotions or perceptions, emotions is a better way maybe than sitting down and really thinking and reasoning. Kahneman and his groups or researchers have really talked about thinking fast and slow. We've got two default ways of thinking, and often the default rapid thinking really works a lot, but sometimes you have to sit down and really think about things. And when we use emotions, it really suggests we're not stopping and thinking about things in a deeper way, which sometimes can get us in trouble.
Absolutely. And I think one of the big emotions that comes into play often with health-related decisions is fear. And we do know that fear, the parts of the brain that govern fear, they actually make it more difficult for the other parts of your brain that summon up reason and rational thinking to function. So the more fired up your fear centers are, the more suppressed your rational thinking centers are. So there's a real conflict there between some of the really intense emotions and then being able to think clearly about things. So sometimes when we give people facts to try to persuade them that maybe the way they're thinking about it is wrong, they can't even process the facts that we're giving them. It's not that they don't understand them because they can't understand them. It's because that they're actually not able to process it because the part of their brain that would churn through that really in a really slow and thoughtful way is really suppressed by the fearful part of their brain.
Right. We have a caller, Dr. Gorman. I want to take her call, and then after that we'll have to take one of our breaks. Carolyn, you're on line one?
Yeah, this is Caroline. I had wanted to ask the question, but first I'll give the example. Steve Jobs was someone who I thought had more money than about anyone and could have perhaps had more chance of preventing the cancer that eventually took his life. And as I recall some of the reportage, it dealt with the fact that he had changed his mind about this new style that he had been going to and had not worked out for him. And I just was wondering, what's the egotistical/emotional, not that he's was egotistical, but what is the process of our tying our decision to our perception of ourselves? Because I've seen some people that I thought would rather ride the horse over the cliff than say, I'm on the wrong horse. That's the question, and Steve Jobs was just such a tragedy.
Right.
Yeah. So that's a great question, and one of the things that we talk about a lot in the book is that perception of self and how you think about yourself in relation to your social group and the community that you're in. And the more when you're very egotistical, as you say, it's very important not to change your mind and not to publicly show that you realized you were wrong. That can be very difficult for everyone, and maybe even a little bit more difficult if you have a heavy ego. So I think in those cases, what happens is that the part of your brain that's really the social part of your brain that's really interested in staying with the group and also maintaining your identity really takes over, and then it becomes very difficult to reason through the facts.
For those individuals who may not be aware, and I'm not going to swear I know the exact story, but my understanding is Steve had pancreatic cancer, and very early on, this is a difficult cancer to treat and cure, but it was found fairly early, and he decided against the prevailing treatment from a medical aspect and used some alternative treatment and eventually succumb to that disease. Is that your understanding as well, Dr. Gorman?
Yes, I've heard that as well. I'm also not an expert on what happened to him, but yes, that was my understanding too.
And that is, unfortunately, a very good example of the title of your book, Denying to the Grave, Why We Ignore Facts That Will Save Us. And here's a very, it makes another point in that here's a very intelligent, very sharp guy who, it appears, made a decision that may have cost him his life. And those, so it suggests that it has very little to do with intelligence, which you also bring up in your book.
Yeah, and that was one of the main drivers for writing it, actually. I felt that the discussion had a lot to do with making sure that people can understand the facts and they don't know the facts. And I kept finding, with the anti-vaccine movement especially, people who were very highly educated, who did have exposure to the correct information and who were perfectly capable of understanding it and did understand it, but were still choosing not to believe it. And so it made me think, you know, there's something going on here. It's not just about knowledge and facts and information, and certainly not about intelligence. And there must be something else going on that probably has more to do with psychology and social forces, and that's really what turned out to be true.
I want to take a short break here. We've undergoing a little bit of a change in line one, where we're going to take breaks around 20 and 40 minutes after we start. So I want to remind our listeners that you're listening to Line One, Your Health Connection. Our local number is 550-8433. Our email address, line1@alaskapublic.org. We're going to take a one-minute break, and then we'll continue our discussion on the psychology of healthcare decision-making and the consequences of those decisions with Dr. Sarah Gorman. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
You're listening to Line One from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 8 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls. You can find Line One on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back. This is Line One from Alaska Public Media in Anchorage, Alaska, and I'm your co-host, Dr. Thad Woodard. My guest today is Dr. Sarah Gorman, author of Denying to the Grave, Why We Ignore Facts That Will Save Us, and we're discussing what we know about healthcare decisions and their consequences. And intermittently through the program, we're discussing how we might all improve this process. You can email questions to us during the next 40 minutes or so at line1@alaskapublic.org. You can call us locally at 550-8433, and you can always call us toll-free as well at 1-888-353-5752. There's been a lot of interesting research on this, the psychology of decision-making in studies where how you present information to people, how you frame it, will make people have different answers, whether, you know, they identify with a feeling about gun control or vaccinations. There's a certain camaraderie or tribe-like benefit that we won't change our ideas, or it's hard to make us see things a little differently. You want to comment about that a little bit more? You've already started to talk about it somewhat, but I think it's fascinating.
Sure, and this is really reflected in the way that the book is structured. The first couple of chapters are about social groups and social psychology, and the last few chapters are more about individual psychology. And that was really purposeful because a lot of the conversation about risk perception and decision making tends to focus on the individual, which is extremely important, the individual psychology. But I also started to notice that some of these anti-science viewpoints had charismatic leaders that were really pushing them forward, and they had social groups around them. And I thought that this was significant because it means that there's a social psychology involved in believing things that don't really go with the evidence. And when you think about it, it actually makes sense in a way. We're really evolved to be sort of social organisms. There's a lot of health benefits and survival benefits to being part of a group. And so people do really seek out groups. And when they are in a group, we tend to really we can sometimes let go of our critical capacities and really just assume that the group is able to evaluate things for us, that we don't necessarily always have to think through everything as carefully, but we can take on the group viewpoint. And this can become dangerous when the group has a viewpoint that doesn't go along with the scientific evidence and that has a potentially detrimental effect for our health, which does happen.
Do you have a concrete example of something along that line?
Yeah, there were a couple of examples in the book that we talked about. I mean, I think in the anti-vaccine world, which is not necessarily a huge group of people who are really committed to that viewpoint, but it's enough that, you know, there have been outbreaks in places where the vaccine for measles, mumps, and rubella is readily available, and people just will refuse to get it for their children. And in that case, I really do think that Andrew Wakefield, who is the person who, he lost his medical license, but he used to be a gastroenterologist in England, and he was the one who put forward the idea that those vaccines cause autism, which was later retracted and debunked. He had falsified data. But he really put that idea forward, and he lives in the U.S. now, and he continues to really promulgate his viewpoints in a very kind of calculated way where he really draws people in. And they become really devoted to his message, despite everything that can happen, you know, from outbreaks to being exposed to more and more data, that there really is no link between vaccines and autism. And what happens is that people really form these groups. They together in a community, they cluster, where a lot of people in one community will not believe the evidence about vaccines. And so, you know, there you have a group that's really basically under the influence of a charismatic leader. And you have a situation where the evidence is not being really considered in a careful way, but rather emotional, social decisions are being made instead.
Recently, I've had some interaction with a patient, she actually reversed this idea somewhat on me. Apparently, there was a researcher with the CDC who, and the CDC is a federal agency that's responsible for looking at a lot of public health information, trying to look at this information as critically, as they can, as unbiased as they can. And we use that information to make decisions about healthcare decisions about whether we should use immunizations, whether we should take immunizations out because there's risks that have been found and so forth. And she brought up that there was a CDC employee, a scientist, that had said that the information was that we were getting from the CDC was biased and that he had made mistakes and so forth. So it works kind of somewhat both ways. And so she was perhaps even more confused by the fact that not only are we concerned about Wakefield's information, but also sometimes scientists with the CDC or another scientific agency have also been accused of problems.
Yeah, and I think this is a larger problem in the scientific system and the way that scientists communicate with the general public, is that when there are mistakes in science, or when there are issues, the conflicts of interest, which does happen. Now, it's not usually on the scale of, you know, kind of the grand conspiracy that some people will tell you, but there are mistakes and there are reversals and there are conflicts of interest. I'm not sure that we always do the best job of really explaining how this happened and being very transparent about what the issues were and how we know that we can continue to protect against them. I mean, those things can come up, and there's no sort of foolproof way to prevent all of those issues, but you know, the scientific system does work very well and does, you know, uncover those things over time. So I think that we could do a little bit of a better job, as we were talking about earlier, about really educating people about how science goes about that process and reassuring them that, you know, even though there are mistakes that can be made, we aim to be transparent about them, and there are remedies for that as well.
Yeah. So what I'm hearing you say is that one of the processes of science is that it because of efforts to try to repeat studies and so forth, it really there becomes a consensus view about the safety of immunizations, or that there's global warming or some such thing, that almost everybody, the vast majority of specialists or experts in an area agree on, but there are always going to be some outliers, and sometimes those outliers may have a good idea. Whether it turns out to be a valid idea depends on repeated testing of that idea to see if it really can be validated or not. And when it can't, I think example is Wakefield. I mean, he is there's very little evidence to suggest his original premise and his studies that were not done correctly really hold any water, and yet he continues to have some influence, despite the fact that there's very little evidence to suggest substantiate his ideas.
Right, especially in that case, his study was not scientifically valid, even though it was published in a very well-regarded journal, The Lancet. But it was ultimately retracted 5 years later. The journal basically came back and said, we take it back. And then that brings up another problem, which is that there are papers that get retracted with some regularity. There's a website called Retraction Watch that actually tracks these. But that doesn't get reported on the way the original study does. So there's a little bit of and it's not like it's happening to every study, but it does happen, and it's very important that news story be elevated, especially if it's something that got a lot of attention in the first place, so that people can really be kept up to date and really shown that the scientific process, I believe, ultimately does work. And if something is not correct and we find that, and it's really something is very wrong with it, it's not scientifically valid, or in Wakefield's case there was also some fraud in the data, then you know, those things do get officially taken back.
Mm-hmm. You've mentioned charismatic leaders as one reason that people and their tribe or their group kind of get caught up and lose the ability to look critically at information. There are some other general problems that have been identified, and you discuss them in your book. If you don't mind, I'd like to maybe take one or two of these and expand on them a little bit more. And one of my favorites has to be coincidence and causality. At one time, I wanted to interview the Click and Clack brothers who did Car Talk, because they did a whole program on coincidence and causality. And I said, it's something we deal with, trying to discuss every day. You want to talk about the issue of coincidence and causality and how that can confuse people?
Sure. It's very interesting. This is actually something that I always thought connected well to my English background, because we humans really like stories. We really like to have a narrative about something, and we like to know, when we have the narrative, we like to know what's the root cause, and then what are all the events that occurred as a result of the root cause. And we look for patterns in our environment. And that's a very natural thing to do. It helps us make sense of the world. It helps us understand what all the many stimuli that come toward us day to day really mean together. The problem is that we often overcompensate and try to make sense of things that don't really have a connection. And in reality, there are actually a lot of things that are pure coincidence. There are lots of things that happen by pure chance. And there are lots of things that we don't know the cause and we might never know the cause. And so we are actually very uncomfortable with just sort of letting that lie and just say, you know, we don't really know what causes this, but we can still proceed because we know how to treat it or we know what it is, even though we don't know the cause. We really feel like we need to investigate what is the cause, and we really don't want any two things that happen simultaneously to be just by chance. We want everything to be connected in that pattern. And this really causes a problem. As I'm sure you know, in medicine, there are lots and lots of things that just happen by chance at the same time that are coincidences. They're not part of one grand disease that's all sort of tied up in a knot. And there are lots of things that we don't know the cause of. And so, you know, this really becomes an issue when there's space there to sort of make up what the cause might be or infer that one thing is connected to something else when it's really not.
And particularly, I would think emotions can then really drive that story of what must be happening. And let me give you the example. Years ago, there was a concern about the immunizations for whooping cough and tetanus, which are given at 2, 4, and 6 months, and some concerns that started in Tennessee, a state where I did my training, that there was an association or a causal effect between those immunizations and sudden infant death syndrome, which peaks during that period of time, 2, 4, and 6 months. That is now forgotten about, I think, but the CDC and other specialists spent a lot of time demonstrating that it was just two things that happened close together in time, much like MMR and autism, which is often not well recognized till after the first year of age, although there's increasing evidence that maybe we can do better than that. So this idea of really a bad thing, emotionally very alarming kinds of situations, and association with things that happened at about the same time, they must be somehow related, but you're saying that that's not necessarily true. Just like I use the example, trying to be funny, hopefully, with some of my patients, that my hair seems to go farther and further. I have less and less of it every time I go to a barber, but we know it's not the barber that's causing my hair to become more and more scarce. It's just time and becoming more bald.
Right. And those things are so ingrained. I mean, I have in my book about how I actually had made this mistake once where I had my computer charger was plugged in, and it wouldn't immediately register the charge. So I would move it closer to the wall, to the outlet, and then it would charge. It would register the charge. But one day I got interrupted while I was doing that, and I walked away, and I didn't get a chance to move my computer closer. And when I came back, it was charging. So I knew that it was really time and not moving it closer to the outlet. I knew that intellectually. But I kept doing that every time I plugged my computer in. I would move it closer to the outlet, thinking that, okay, I have to do this for it to charge. And so sometimes even when you know intellectually, right, you know, you just have that impulse. It's very strong, and it really comes from a very deep psychological place where you really want everything to be connected.
I read on something getting into preparation for Daniel Kahneman, who wrote this fantastic, and again, won the Nobel Prize for how we sometimes make irrational decisions. He says even he sometimes will get some lottery tickets and see if he can he can win when he knows it's very, very unlikely that that's going to work for him.
Exactly.
All right. We're up to the time for one more of our breaks. You're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection. Our local number is 550-8433, 550-8433. Our email address, line1@alaskapublic.org. We're going to take a one-minute break again and continue our discussion on the psychology of healthcare decision-making and some of the consequences of those decisions with Dr. Sarah Gorman. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
You're listening to Line 1 from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 8 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls. You can find Line 1 on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back. This is Line 1, your health connection from Alaska Public Media in Anchorage, Alaska, and I'm your co-host, Dr. Thad Woodard. My guest today, Dr. Sarah Gorman. She is the author of Denying to the co-author, I should say, of Denying to the Grave, Why We Ignore Facts That Will Save Us. Very, very good book for all of us to read. We all make some very bad decisions based on the way our brain has evolved, somewhat, I think, to protect us, but it leads us into problems sometimes. And we're discussing what's known about the healthcare decisions and the consequences. And I'm hoping in the next 20 minutes to get into some ideas about how health professionals can talk to individuals about how to make better health decisions and perhaps some advice from Dr. Gorman about how we all can make some better decisions. If you have questions or comments, our local number again, 550-8433. Our email address, line1@alaskapublic.org, and our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. Dr. Gorman, I did get an email. It's a very short email with two questions. It says, aren't some people so rooted in their behavior that to change would mean loss of identity? So it's kind of, again, this protective mechanism we have not to say that, to lose face and admit that we've been wrong, I think is what this writer is getting at. And then the second question is, what do you think about the idea that there is a reliance gene? And I'm not exactly sure what that means, but maybe you do, but it does get us into some of the, maybe some genetic issues that you might want to comment.
Sure. I'll take the first question. I also am not sure what's meant by the reliance gene, so
<Okay.
laughs> I might have to put that aside for now. But that's a great question about losing identity. And as I alluded to before, I think that's really an important part of this discussion that's sometimes not brought up, and the social aspects, really, of what it means to change your mind. It's very difficult, especially in this day and age, when people will often publicly profess what they think about things on social media, et cetera. It can be very difficult to backtrack from that, and more so when that opinion is really affiliated with a certain social group that's very important to your overall social life, but also to your identity. And one of the things that's interesting about that we find is that people who have complex, what's kind of called a complex social identity, where they belong to many different groups, and especially if those groups are don't often go together. So, for instance, a female chief executive officer of a big company. So those are sort of two groups that are sometimes, being a female and also being a CEO of a large company is actually not that common, which is a whole other topic, but in reality it's not that common. And having different social identities, especially ones that don't mesh together as frequently, actually makes people more tolerant and more able to change their mind, because they have many different aspects of their identity that they can sort of separate out and shift modes more easily. The more you are very identified with one social group that takes over your whole identity, the more likely you are to fall into some beliefs that are very hard to change.
Okay. All right. Yeah, and I'll have to beg off the reliance gene kind of idea. I don't know if, there's so much in our genes that I think we really don't appreciate. We see things in kids, infants very, very early in life that they can't have learned from other individuals that they do, that suggests there's some very, very deep things in our genes that are kind of interesting. And it's also important to recognize that the way our nervous system functions is that we learn what we learned very, very early, we've talked about on this program a number of times, is really gets to be hard to change. So some of our belief systems may be very ingrained very early in our life, which is actually independent of the genes. But that's as far as I think I can take that second question myself. What I'd like to do now is perhaps get into this idea of how do we talk to other individuals, both professionally or maybe our friends, and trying to help them look at some evidence a little bit differently. And to do this, I'm going to try to summarize a podcast from This American Life that I just happened to listen to before this as I knew I was going to be interviewing you. And it's podcast number 635. There's from This American Life. It's a link on our website, and it's called A Chip in My Brain. And what this is about is a boy named Cody who his parents wanted him to be a little bit better at basketball, and they gave him a private basketball coach early in his life named AJ. And for years, he was helping Cody get better at basketball, which he really did. But unbeknownst to them, he was also getting some other education, quote, unquote. And it was really had to do with the Bible and the Book of Revelations and what's going to happen to us all, and the rapture, and that the Illuminati were out and programming us all, and that these all of us were going to have RFID chips put in our hands and foreheads, and which was kind of, again, a high-tech version of the number 666. So Cody's parents finally stumbled on to this belief system that now Cody had from his basketball coach. And David Kastenbaum, the host of the program, is quoted, and I'm going to read this part. I've tried to summarize everything else, so I didn't have to read much. But the question came from his parents: how do you convince somebody? This is David Kastenbaum. How do you convince someone that their whole worldview is wrong? Cody's therapist's take was that you couldn't. Cody was going to have to decide for himself. One counselor who handled cases like this put it in this way that really stuck with me. He said, you have to help the fly find its way out of the bottle. The idea being that the fly in a bottle doesn't know it's in the bottle because the walls are transparent. But if you can get it to see the bottle, it can find its way out. Cody's therapist never told Cody that what he believed was wrong. He just asked questions, tried to create a place where Cody felt safe to talk about these things and to think about them. Cody did start to question things. So this is me again. So this got me thinking about this whole idea of beliefs and denying evidence and confirmation bias. And cults and brainwashing, which just seem like maybe a greater degree of the same thing. But my point is here is what I'd like to ask is there anything we can learn from this, quote, model of a fly in a bottle to help patients change their beliefs and make healthier decisions? And you address this issue of suggestions that health providers and others may use to help people make decisions a little bit better.
Yeah, I think as healthcare providers and also public health professionals do this too, we're very used to, you know, we have the evidence at our disposal, and so we can tell people what the facts are. So we can simply just tell them what's right and what's wrong, and that should be enough. And the reality is, as we've talked about for the past 50 minutes or so, and what is in my book, of course, is that it's much more complicated than that. And so what I really like about what you just read is that it really illustrates this concept that's more about what we call motivational interviewing, which really has to do with, it's really a process. It comes actually from substance abuse counseling originally, but it's a concept that really is about really leading somebody to understand their own ambivalence or their own doubts about a belief that they hold or a behavior that they have, and so that they kind of they can understand, they can lead themselves out of a bad situation that they might be in or an incorrect belief. And it's the reason why that was developed is because when somebody with a substance abuse problem would see a counselor, and the counselor would simply say, "You need to stop drinking," and that was the end of it. You know, it was very ineffective because the person felt like they couldn't stop drinking and they didn't really want to, so they would just not go back to see the counselor. When the counselor approached it a little bit more gently and would say things like, "Is there anything about your drinking that does bother you, or is there anything that what are your underlying goals, and how is the drinking maybe not helping you reach those goals?" Then the counselor and the person could sort of meet in the middle, and they would open up the conversation. So it takes more time to actually walk through with somebody and ask them questions and understand how did they come to form the belief, and then have them really examine that closely and walk them through hopefully coming out of that belief. It takes more time, and that can be a barrier sometimes, but it can be very effective even when a belief is very, very important to someone, as in that example that you just gave.
And I would agree that motivational interviewing is something that's being suggested to a large degree to physicians. And I think physicians, like the counselor you gave the example to in the past, of patients are often told by the physician, "You need to lose weight, you need to get control of your high blood pressure, you need to eat less salt," or something like that. And that's, like you said, when you... patients go home, they're not successful with it, then they don't come back, they don't discuss it. So we've really lost the opportunity to help them manage some change, and that motivational interviewing is a way to do that. And I think you're right. I think that is true. I'm not very good at it. I'm constantly now trying to get better at it. But from a little bit more practical standpoint, you know, it costs patients money to keep coming back to talk about these things,
right,
and spend the time doing that. So we get into this time dilemma. It would be nice to be able to quickly say, you know, something to make change with behavior. It's just, I don't know. It's a little impractical, but I think it's right. I just wish I had a quicker, faster way to do the same thing.
Absolutely. And I wish that, for example, that insurance companies would pay for the doctor's time to do that, because it's really important. But yeah, right, there are some structural problems with it. But you can also try it. Mm-hmm. When you mentioned before, you know, not just for healthcare providers, but in other kinds of interactions, but family members. I get a lot of questions. People say they have a family member who doesn't believe something, you know, is not going to get a vaccine, et cetera, and they're worried. How should they discuss it with that person? And so thinking about the motivational interviewing model, you know, you're not going to go and get completely trained in how to do that, but there are certain principles that you can pick up relatively easily about how you approach the conversation that can really change the conversation you end up happening. So it is kind of an approach you can try with more casually with people in your life, like friends and family as well.
Could you also make a couple of suggestions? You have a number of guiding principles at the end of the book, and some solutions even. Maybe touch on one or two things that you think are very important for us to just briefly mention for helping people make better decisions.
Yeah, I think there are a couple that are very that are big suggestions that have to do with things like how we teach science to young people and some of the more systemic changes that I think need to happen. But I think one thing that everyone can do is spend a little bit more time with the health information they get day to day. Some of the things we talked about toward the beginning, about how do you know if health and science information you're getting is valid or not, try to check yourself the next time you immediately, you know, get behind some new study that you found that you think is convincing. Try to check yourself and ask and slow down for a minute and ask yourself, well, is there any potential here that something is not right? And maybe look up the author, maybe look up the journal, and maybe look up, you know, one other news coverage item on that, on that same study, or even the study itself. You know, just try that the next time you look at a study. I think everyone would benefit from trying to do that a little bit more. So that's one thing, and really being cognizant of the way that you consume that information. And then, you know, I do think that that people should be educated about what are some of the reasons why someone might not believe the evidence, and to try to really slow down when they have those encounters, to not get angry at the at another person who's expressing that they don't believe the evidence, because that's a very strong impulse that we have, to then we throw evidence back at people, and that can backfire as well. So just being more careful about how you have those conversations is important as well.
All right. We're in our last couple of minutes, and I've gotten into the habit of just asking our guests to make a few brief comments about what you think are important bits of information you want listeners to take away from the program, understanding that we won't remember everything, but we can get back and listen to this program again if we'd like to from our links in our program. But how would you answer that question? What do you want listeners to take away today?
I think the key point that I always make is that really at the center of the book is that not believing in scientific evidence or quote unquote denying the evidence is actually something that we all engage in to various degrees, and it's absolutely universal. And doctors and scientists and public health professionals and highly trained people are also, everyone is vulnerable to these things, and a lot of the impulses are very natural. So that's one thing I want people to take away, to realize that it's not a matter of intelligence and training necessarily, but it really, there really are a lot of natural social and psychological processes that get involved in why sometimes people don't believe the evidence. That would be one thing. And I think the second thing would be to really work on the interactions that you have with people around this evidence, and try to take a step back and not have those screaming matches that people sometimes have about some of these issues, and really try to have a conversation, you know, maybe using some of the motivational interviewing techniques, and maybe just taking a break from the conversation if it becomes heated and coming back to it, but really trying to have those conversations in a calmer, more calculated way, and understanding that we're all vulnerable to some of these viewpoints.
Well, thanks very much. It's really been a pleasure having you here. My thanks to Dr. Sarah Gorman for being with us today, and for writing Denying to the Grave, Why We Ignore the Facts That Will Save Us. If you'd like to be a listener who wants to continue this discussion on KSKA, you can join that discussion on Facebook, and you can find that website at www.alaskapublic.org, where you can also find resources for today's program and our Line 1 archives. Dr. Gorman, thanks again, and have a great day.
Thank you.
Next week, Line 1 is going to return, and our co-host, Prentice Pemberton, will be talking about a psychological mental health topic. That'll be Monday, April 9th, and repeats the same evening at 8 p.m. on FM 91.1, Alaska Public Media. I want to thank Dr. Dave Waldron, who was today's audio engineer, and Eric Bark, who does our web editing. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day.
Line 1 is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Learn more about Line 1 and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.